submarines, and aviation, none of which had yet found expression on the battlefield, nor had another wartime factor been considered in a global conflict, the involvement of the U.S. military. World War I is the story of how the Western world became enmeshed in the bloodiest and most destructive military deadlock that had yet been seen in human history. It's also the story of how a relatively young country experienced its own rite of passage on the world stage, helped break the deadlock in Europe, and found itself a key player in international relations. The U.S. approached the war with reluctance, until its own interests were at stake. As seen earlier, two events were critical in moving U.S. policy away from isolationism to active military participation. Germany's unlimited submarine warfare, which threatened to cripple American merchant shipping, and the discovery of a plot that would pave the way for a possible German invasion through Mexico. On April 6, 1917, the U.S. declared war on Germany. U.S. Treasury Secretary William McAdoo summed up the reasons for American intervention in this fundraising address.
We are by nature peaceful people, but we are a fighting people where the rights of America and of humanity are concerned. The Kaiser insolently commanded our vessels and our citizens not to sail the high seas within a zone of about 500 miles surrounding Great Britain, France, Belgium, and Italy. He said, if you do, I will sink your ships without notice, kill your citizens, and destroy your comrades. If we had submitted to that order, and that had been destroyed, what would have happened? Disaster upon the farms of America. Disaster to the manufacturers of America. Disaster to the mining interests of America. Disaster to the labor interests of America. To every productive activity of the American people, there would have come irreparable injury. Never could we submit to that.
A draft was instituted, and the U.S. military was ramped up from a force of around 120,000 to one of more than 4.5 million. Armaments soon poured from American factories. Training camps were created or expanded to take in the huge influx of new recruits. The American public voiced its unquestioned support of the Wilson administration's war aims, though few knew just what the aim of the war really was. The answer most soldiers gave, we're here because we're here.
We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here.
Brigadier General Stephen Burkheiser is executive director of the Liberty Memorial.
If you go back to the beginning, before World War I even started, and look at America, we surely were not a world player, politically, militarily, or even economically. We hadn't hit our stride at all. And for the U.S. to make the decision to go into World War I, we were essentially, as President Wilson put together in his 14 points, we were talking about values, about making the world safe for democracy, liberty, democracy. These have been an element of our foreign policy, starting really with the World War I period. And of course, this was our first major deployment, sending military forces overseas.
Tell me of the war of 1917, said his grandson who stood by his side. How did they fix up that terrible mix-up? And proudly the old man replied, the Russians were rushing the Prussians. The Prussians were crushing the Russians. The Balkans were balking, and Turkey was walking, Rasputin disputing, and Italy hooting. The vultures all bold, Bolsheviki. The British were watching the sea. But the good Lord, I'm thanking, the Yanks started yanking, and Yankeiser filled up a tree.
And so the United States settled into the realities of a world war, one far away from American shores but connected suddenly to its emerging sense of self. Led by General John Pershing, the American Expeditionary Force embodied the American spirit of independence. While working side by side with the Allied armies of France and Great Britain, Pershing's army was an independent fighting force with its own commander, its own war aims, and its own military muscle. At the Battle of Belleau Wood, when urged by French commander to retreat, Captain Lloyd Williams summed up the AEF's fighting spirit with his famous reply, "Retreat? Hell, we just got here."
"You're a grand old flag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true on the red, white, and blue, when they never oppose or rank. Drop your load of wings and sleep for glam. Keep your eye on the grand old flag."
The arrival of the American doughboys brought renewed optimism to the Allied soldiers. They brought their naive American confidence, their good humor, and above all, their determination to, quote, kill the Boche. The American soldiers also brought their differing attitudes toward race relations. African American soldiers were segregated or placed in non-combat roles. Many of the black U.S. combat units were handed over to the French for use in the trenches, which, for most African-American soldiers, would be the only time they would fight side-by-side with white troops. Back home, the roving eye of racial injustice had moved from African-Americans to German-speaking immigrants. The late 19th and early 20th century had seen the largest influx of European immigration in American history. Many unassimilated German speakers lived in German districts, read German-language newspapers, and shopped at German markets. In 1917, James W. Girard, former U.S. ambassador to Germany, gave a speech to the Ladies' Aid Society in which he suggested that action should be taken against any Germans who questioned America's commitment to beating Germany.
"Fortunately, the great majority of American citizens of German descent have, in this great crisis of our history, shown themselves splendidly loyal to our flag. Everyone had a right to sympathize with any warring nation. But now that we are in the war, there are only two sides, and the time has come when every citizen must declare himself American or traitor. And if there are any German Americans here who are so ungrateful for all the benefits they have received that they are still for the Kaiser, there is only one thing to do with them, and that is to hogtie them. Give them back the wooden shoes and the rags they landed in and ship them back to the fatherland."
For the veterans of the First World War who were too young to fight, like 106-year-old veteran John Babcock, who spent the war in England as a 16-year-old in the Young Soldiers Battalion, the horror was often experienced secondhand.
"My brother, my half-brother, Manley, he bought me out for joining the Army. He joined the engineers and became a sapper. They would dig tunnels under the enemy's lines, and they put a bunch of explosives in there and then blow them up. He said he dug into one tunnel one time where the Germans were. The tunnel had been blown in behind them, and they were just sitting there. They were dead, used up the air that was in that place, and wasn't any place for him to go. He got buried up to his waist one time, and he had a nervous breakdown after he got out of the service."
But training camp was a wartime society of its own, and brought its own contact with death. Babcock remembers two fellow soldiers for whom the pressure of war was too much.
"He was from Germany, and I think that he'd done something in Germany, and they were catching up on him, and he found out about it. And he came in, he'd been on guard, and he says, 'Well, boys,' he says, 'here goes.' And there was a first sergeant there. He said, 'Give me that gun.' But he says, 'Don't try to get this gun.' And he did shot himself. He put the gun in his head and pulled the trigger. Well, I was right there when he did it. Then I remember one time, there was a kid got pack drill. You'd have to put your pack on and walk around the barracks. It hurt this kid's feelings so to do this, that he got up at night and took a bayonet, put the hilt against the wall, and jabbed it through his chest and killed himself. Jeez, I felt sorry for that kid, because it really was not much of a disgrace to have pack drill, but it hurt his feelings so that he killed himself."
Soldiers defending America's southern border were not immune to the stresses of war, as Samuel Goldberg remembers.
"There was a older man from Oklahoma. He looked 60. He was, I think, 33 or 4. And they used to call him Pop because he was so old. He was whiskey-soaked. And he said to me one day, "I'm going to go over the hill. I'm sick and tired of this." Over the hill means desert, run away. And I sat down. I said, "They'll follow you. They'll pick you up in your hometown in Oklahoma, and they'll send you to prison." I said, "You don't do it. You feel lonesome, come see me, we'll talk a little," so on. I was a Jewish mother to a lot of them. What fun I had.
The war, which many in the summer of 1914 thought would be over by Christmas, had dragged on for nearly 3 deadly years by the time the main force of U.S. troops arrived in the winter of 1917 and 1918. Pershing hoped for an American rather than an Allied victory, and his tactics centered on pushing back the German line and moving the war to German soil. American Army and Marine forces proved instrumental in breaking the German lines, but soon even the indomitable Pershing was caught in the quagmire of the Western Front. Belleau Wood, the Argonne Forest, the Meuse, and Saint-Mihiel were soon familiar place names to Americans back home. 110-year-old Tony Piero is the last American veteran who saw action at the Argonne and Meuse offensives.
You get in the army, a wartime, your life is not yours. You're there to be used. You have an enemy, you want to kill him. That's the aim, that was the idea. Get a hold of the enemy and kill him, so he won't shoot at you anymore. The enemy is always looking. Shoot to kill. What's the sense of shooting at you, at each other? Somebody's going to get killed. So it's nice to be in peace and do what you want. Nobody tells you what to do. You do it your own way.
As is often the case in war, taking prisoners often posed logistical problems. The trench fighting and the constant threat of attack made it impossible to construct detention camps. On the other hand, prisoners couldn't simply be released. John Babcock.
The boys, after you've been in the front line and fighting for a while, you got kind of callous about life. I heard the veterans talking about when they take German prisoners, and they were escorting them back to the air, they'd take them back to the reserve trenches and shoot them. Jesus, I thought that was terrible. It was terrible. But when you get in war, you get hardened to life. Life doesn't mean a hell of a lot to you anymore.
The newly arrived Americans were perhaps less hardened than their war-weary allies. Tony Piero.
In the army, when they get caught prisoners, they get rid of them. They don't fool around. They shoot them. Target practice. Sure, that's what they're using for. They use it for target practice. The Americans didn't believe it that way. The Americans are taking a prisoner, and they treated them as prisoners.
The Germans responded to the arrival of the U.S. with an all-out offensive aimed at cutting through to the Channel ports and re-establishing their maritime supply lines. Despite the departure of the Russians and the end of fighting on Germany's eastern border, the Germans were no match for the remounting strength of the Allies, nor could the German population keep up with the need for new bodies and provisions. In an act of desperation that would be repeated in the next World War, Germany sent its children and middle-aged men to don guns and fill the gaps. But soon the Allied steamroller left the Germans with one alternative. With the threat of revolution in Germany and pressure from the United States, Kaiser Wilhelm II abdicated. And on November 9, 1918, Germany was declared a republic. 2 days later, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of the year, the guns were stilled, and all was quiet on the Western Front.
I couldn't believe it. Really. The war was over. Oh boy, what a day. the sergeant come out and told the story that the peace was declared and let's be happy that we're still alive. It was just like a new day, just like the sun had come out of the cloud.
George Johnson.
We heard the war was over. Oh boy, we couldn't get out of there quick enough. That morning, the guys running down the road hollering, the war's over, the war's over, the war's over. We couldn't believe what they were talking about. Thought they were drunk or something.
Lloyd Brown.
Oh yeah, big celebration, yeah. Hugs and kisses from the girls on the streets in Philadelphia, that's where I was. But anyway, they were giving the service people a good time.
Frank Buckles.
And the war was over. America wanted to forget about it. And I realized that my experience was an important thing.
These are the notes of the last post, a trumpet call which is performed each night at the Menin Gate outside Ypres, scene of some of the worst fighting in the war. With so many monuments, so many cemeteries, the First World War has never been far from the Western European consciousness. Drive through any Belgian, French, or German town, large or small, and the first thing you'll come to is an obelisk inscribed with the names of the town's World War I losses. Similar monuments adorn the town plazas and courthouse squares of many American cities, though America's memory of World War I has been overshadowed by the Second World War. General Stephen Burkheiser, Executive Director of the Liberty Memorial.
Well, great events typically overshadow the great events that came before them, and World War II surely did that, and especially in the American conscience, because we were involved in World War II almost from the beginning, whereas we were relatively latecomers to World War I.
Frank Buckles.
The emphasis on always the last war, and I don't think that the country ever realized the importance of what World War I meant, and it was the whole world was involved in it. A very serious business.
The First World War had few clearly defined heroes or villains. It was a war fought not in response to the sweeping, maniacal ambitions of a Hitler, but in response to treaty violations and national pride. America entered the war to make the world safe for democracy, as Wilson put it, though with clearly defined national interests at heart. The United States lost some 57,000 men in the roughly 18 months that U.S. troops were committed in Europe. U.S. involvement was critical in breaking the long deadlock along the Western Front and bringing a speedy end to a war which might have raged on in the old European fashion for another decade or more. Dr. William Adams.
I do believe that had we stayed out, the British and the French and their allies with their empires would have eventually defeated the Germans, but it might have taken, you know, another 20 years, like during the Napoleonic Wars. I think it was clear that the bulk of the right was on the side of the British and the French. I would have preferred the world they would have made to the one that the Germans would have made.
Dr. Anthony Knott, Professor Emeritus of the University of Texas, Brownsville, Texas Southmost College.
In the peace agreement, the greedy elements on the winning side took advantage of the situation and benefited themselves and set up situations that would later come back to haunt Europe.
For a very short while after World War I, after the peace treaty, I think countries saw the fact that the democracies had been victorious. France, Britain, America, the strongest democracies were victorious. I think that gave added impetus to the idea of a democratic country. I think before World War I, a lot of people thought that the autocratic countries such as Germany, Russia, Austrian-Hungarian Empire, because of the fact they don't have to bother with parliamentary debate, the slowness of democracy, in wartime would be more efficient. But in the end, it was those great autocracies that collapsed. The Russian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Austrian Empire, the German Empire. So I think for a short while, people saw, the way to go is with a democracy. But before the 20s were out, already we saw that the democracies were struggling with the Depression in 29, inflation, the Weimar Republic in Germany failed. So I think it was very short-lived.
The war officially ended in June 1919, 7 months after the armistice, with the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. Here a defeated Germany was forced to accept full responsibility for the war, to restore territories taken half a century earlier, to decommission its military, and pay reparations that would prove devastating to the already crushed German economy.
The big three had completely different goals for the treaty. David Lloyd George was mainly there to extract as much money as he could out of Germany. Tiger Clemenceau, for the French, I think is simply looking for security. The idea of first breaking up Germany came to mind, perhaps break it down into as many as a dozen smaller countries as it had been before it was unified. And then you had the idealist, Wilson, to show up with his 14 points, completely at odds with the other two. I think if either one of them had gotten their way, we would have had a better peace. Had Lloyd George and Clemenceau had their way, they would have crushed Germany. I don't think there would have been a Second World War. They would have not risen. Or had Wilson had his way, maybe with the idealism, generosity towards Germany, the motive for revenge wouldn't have been there. You know, if you're in a dangerous fight with someone and you finally have them down on the ground, you have a choice. You can finish them off, or you can show generosity, help them up, help dust them off, pat them on the back, and maybe you can get along in the future. The peace we had, it would be like holding the man down, poking out one of their eyes, breaking one of their arms, and kicking them. But they're going to be able to get up eventually, and they're going to be angry.
9 years after the controversial treaty was signed, Frank Buckles was traveling by ship to Germany when he met two well-connected Germans who took him in their confidence.
He says, "We're going to tell you something that will surprise you and you don't know. We're planning for another war." And they both of them had been officers and high-ranking people. And they said, "We're not in favor of it. And many of the other officers of good backgrounds are opposed to it. But nevertheless, we are going to have another war." And that was 10 years after the armistice.
World War II might be seen as the continuation of World War I. The old monarchies and rivalries may have been a thing of the past, but national pride ran just as strong in the late 1930s as when a Serbian nationalist fired into the Austrian Archduke's motorcade. The Versailles Peace Treaty brought closure to the First World War, but the peace was only temporary. In a moment, a final tribute to America's oldest veterans as the World War I Living History Project continues.
Funding for the World War I Living History Project is provided by the National World War I Museum at the Liberty Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri. Experience, learn, and honor those who served in defense of liberty in our country at the nation's only federally designated museum honoring the veterans of the First World War. Online at libertymemorialmuseum.org.
This is Will Everett with the conclusion of the World War I Living History Project. A dozen years ago, while living in France, I paid my first visit to the trenches. I had heard that after the armistice, with 500 miles of trenches to deal with, some had been left intact for posterity, exactly as they had been when the soldiers all trudged home after the war. One such sector was at Ypres, a medieval town of fairy tale splendor in western Belgium that had been leveled to the ground in World War I. Farmers in the area still plow up old gun stocks, bullets, and bones in these flat, placid fields. One misty morning, I met a World War I veteran, a man in his mid-90s being led by the arm by his elderly son. They might have been just out for a cold-weather stroll, except that the old man seemed to be looking for something. They were walking along an observation platform, looking down into the trench, which was so much deeper than it looks in pictures. Every few yards, the 90-something-year-old man would peer into the trench, then up at the nearby ridge, as if trying to get his bearings. Later, while the father was walking alone, I spoke to the son. I asked him if his father was a veteran, and he said he was. I asked what they were looking for, and he said, "After it rains, things come up from the mud. Things that have been buried for 75 years suddenly come to the surface, and with the next rain, they sink back again forever. You can see the strangest things." Belgium's World War I veterans are all gone now. The last one died in 2004. Scotland lost its last veteran a year ago. The last Austrian and Hungarian veterans both died in March, an odd coincidence, considering that the two countries were once part of the same empire. As of October 2006, France and Germany each had 8 veterans. Britain had 5. Canada had 3. At the start of the year, the United States had 24 surviving World War I veterans. Now there are only 14. In some ways, it was the memory of an old man staring down into that tomb-like trench that sent me at the beginning of the year to document the experiences of America's surviving World War I veterans. I encountered a lot of people along the way who would say, "Oh, my dad or my grandpa was in the war," until they realized that I was talking about the other World War. Invariably, they'd do a double take. Wasn't that around 1915? Then they'd do the math. It was a very long time ago, and I realized as I began traveling across the country to interview these centenarians that this country would soon be coming up on the end of a historically important era, an end that not too many people seemed to know was even approaching. They weren't members of the greatest generation. Newsreel photography was scarcely out of its infancy when they were slogging it out in the trenches of Belgium and France. Sound movies hadn't yet been invented. Without much to remember them by, history seemed all too willing to simply let them go, these veterans and their distant, hard-to-reach point in history. Historians mark the end of any major era with the passing of its last veteran. The last Revolutionary War veteran died in 1869, 86 years after the war. The last Civil War veteran most likely died in 1953, 87 years after the war. It's been 88 years since the armistice. The veterans remaining represent only 0.03% of the original 4.5 million doughboys. Given that one of the veterans, Emiliano Mercado del Toro of Puerto Rico, is 115 years old, perhaps it's conceivable that one of the youngsters of the bunch, the 105-year-olds who snuck in as boys of 16, will be around for the centennial of World War I. Frank Buckles, for one, says he plans to live to be 125, and I believe he just might do it. The veterans interviewed for this program are not the only U.S. World War I veterans out there. There were surprisingly few veterans who couldn't be interviewed, but there were some for whom time had simply taken too great a toll, but who should be remembered, like Charlotte Winters, a Navy veteran and the oldest female veteran in the United States, or Emiliano Mercado del Toro of Puerto Rico and Albert Wagner in Kansas. And then there are the veterans who signed on too late to be considered World War I veterans, like Robley Rex, Stillman Munger, and Maurice Starkey. And we cannot leave out a curiosity like Harold Gardner, who got on the train to go to boot camp on November 11, 1918, and was told to get off the train a few hours later when the armistice was signed, and received a paycheck of $1 for his one day in the U.S. Army. The surviving U.S. veterans of World War I aren't a brotherhood of heroes. You realize right away that the story isn't about heroics on the battlefield. The war touched all of them, but not in the way you come to expect when you approach veterans to hear their stories. Their wartime contributions were simple, their military service sometimes unpleasant, but usually dull. But most of these old soldiers had a few things in common. For one thing, they were all quite young. They were between 16 and 21 when they joined, and anxious to see some action, about which the curious interviewer can hardly help wanting to know more. We tend to think of veterans as tin soldiers who live on as symbols of this war or that. Part of my search for the last World War I veterans was a search for common ground, a connection to the past that would help me to understand such a remote point in time. When it came to talking about their personal lives, I found that not much had really changed. As John Babcock was patient to remind me, they were healthy young men who did what healthy young men are prone to do.
I heard a lot of stories about France, about the guys fraternizing with the prostitutes. I remember one fellow telling about visiting a prostitute, and they gave her some francs, and she put them in her stocking, and she had a hole in the leg of her stocking, and the francs were falling out as she walked down the stairs. He followed it on, was picking the francs up. Oh, you heard a lot of stories in the service, believe me.
Tony Piero.
Beautiful girls. They're all over the place. There was one girl in Bordeaux. She was a saint. She was nice. A girl said, "You can have any part of me." I'm too busy. Busy being a soldier.
Howard Ramsey.
When I was over in France, on leave one time, I remember we took a walk and we met a couple French girls. And we didn't have any money, so they took us home where they lived. And we met their mother and their father. So we had quite a nice time as long as we knew those two girls. They were just, about the same age that we were.
Homer Anderson.
Oh, yes, I danced lots of time. I liked lady friends. And that was one way of having a nice lady friend, because they loved to dance, the majority of them. And I was a pretty good dancer in that age. Met quite a few nice young ladies that way. Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, these were innocent romances that didn't go very far. But not always. Samuel Goldberg.
In that cheetah, there was just one prostitute. She kept busy. And then the baker, the bread baker, he marries her. He married this prostitute. I put the paper through.
But 112-year-old George Johnson was too busy having adventures. The story of his life is an adventure classic. He told me that before I could understand his military experience, I had to know something of how he first came to learn that the world was at war. When George was about 16, he and a friend were canoeing on the Delaware River near Philadelphia when they came upon an Argentinian battleship. Naturally, they wanted to climb aboard and look it over, and while Johnson was down below, the ship pushed away from the pier, and he was carried off as an accidental stowaway.
I looked around, I couldn't see the wharf. What in the world? Where's the wharf? I noticed a fellow standing at the opposite side of the deck. And I said to the guy, where's the boat? Where's it going? I never will forget the words he spoke. La vapor, she vamos para Buenos Aires. The boat was going to Buenos Aires. That's where it was going. Sailing down the Delaware River. Going on its way to open sea.
He spent 2 years trying to get home. And it was while traveling to England on a merchant ship that he first learned of the German submarines that were now prowling the Atlantic. He arrived back home just in time to be drafted. Understanding the world of 1917 and 1918 meant understanding how these men filled their incidental hours, what they did for fun. As it turned out, life was pretty mundane for the average soldier or sailor in World War I, but they always found ways of livening things up. John Babcock.
We had a canvas shoes we used to wear for athletic work, and they used to put our overcoats on, our greatcoats, and our canvas shoes, and we used to go down to the ocean in Bexhill and go swimming. And we'd throw our overcoats off and our shoes, we were buck naked. But it was about 6 o'clock in the morning and people weren't up yet, but anyway, nobody bothered us. It was chilly.
Samuel Goldberg.
After the meal at night, a lot of us would play poker. I'll tell you a funny one. The 24th Infantry Negroes came over, and they were playing blackjack. And so I got into the game. I had, $10 or so. And I won within an hour or so. I won a very tidy sum, $125. Exactly. $125. And I decided to quit. I said, it's not going to run my way too much longer. And I walked away 10 steps or so, and the guy by the name of Dawson approaches me, one of our cavalrymen. He said, "Hi, Goldie, we got a game going, stud poker." Well, right there I should have stopped, because I'm good at poker, very good, not at stud poker. I think no more than 15 minutes to lose $125. And to this day, I'm mad with myself. 87 years ago, almost 90 years ago, and I still have bad vibes over that. Funny, isn't it? Follows you the rest of your life.
Ernest Pusey.
Old board ship, they play a lot of cards, and they get in those crap games and wouldn't stop until somebody was broke.
Military service also taught the veterans lessons about themselves, some of which they had to learn the hard way.
When war was over, we were allowed to go ashore and buy beer. I wasn't much of a beer drinker, but that day I drank too much. And they walked me up and down the street to get me sober to go aboard ship. And I just walked right up to the dock and walked right down in the water. And they pulled me in. That's the way I went aboard ship.
I'd just been paid, and I had about 3 cocktails, you know, whiskey and soda or whatever it was. And then I went to a restaurant and had a meal. And I felt kind of drunk. And I went home to camp, and I got in bed, and the guys had left a fire back up by my bed, and that was the last time I got drunk. I wasn't a good drinker.
The First World War was also a cultural phenomenon, a time preserved in song. When I visited John Babcock in Washington State, I was curious about the music of the time. I wondered if he remembered the old songs, and would he share them with me?
Pack up your troubles in your old gift bag. Smile, smile, smile. While you've a Lucifer to light your fag. Smile, boys, that's a style. How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris?
How
are
you
going to
keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? Hey!
And then that song that came out, Katie, beautiful Katie, you're the girl that I adore. When the moon shines over the cow shed, I'll be waiting at the kitchen door.
When I first approached the Office of Veterans Affairs for a list of World War I veterans, I suspected there might be others. 80% of the VA's World War I records went up in flames when the Records Center in St. Louis burned down in the 1970s. The only veterans known to the VA were those who received medical checks. Then, during the production of this program, the VA got a call from a man in Rhode Island checking to see if any of his old cavalry buddies were still around. As it turned out, not only were Samuel Goldberg's buddies gone, he was the last cavalry soldier left. Goldie, as he sometimes calls himself, was a rarity, the last witness to a little-known corner of World War I history with contemporary significance. He was posted on the U.S.-Mexico border following the Pancho Villa raids as part of an effort to thwart a possible German invasion through Mexico.
We drilled every day. I used to laugh and say, "We're fighting the Indians again. Get out there in the morning, right on, right after breakfast, and run around that desert like you were fighting for your life." I laughed at it in 1918. I was an 18-year-old kid, and I laughed. I said, what are we doing? Fighting, drilling to fight Indians? We were supposed to be guarding against Germans coming through from Mexico. The Germans had their group in Mexico with the intention of crossing into the U.S., and logical enough.
His travels along the U.S.-Mexico border also brought him in contact with Fort Brown in Brownsville, just down the road from our studios.
We spent like 5 months there in Brownsville. We were, this was a false alarm. They were going to ship both squadrons of the 12th from Columbus and the Cheetah down to join the other squadron in Panama. And we were supposed to get summer clothes and so on and ship off from Brownsville for Panama. But they canceled it.
The World War I veterans I met for this program all had their own attitudes about longevity. People would say to me, I bet they all drank and smoked right up until they were 100. And actually, many did smoke in their early lives, and many still drank in moderation. But for the most part, the veterans I met had been living moderate, sensible lives for some time, watching what they ate and what they drank. I asked them to share their secrets. How can one reach the age of 105, 110, 112, and be as robust as these guys seem to be? Frank Buckles.
What's important is you got a strong desire to live. Recently, there have been a number of stories about longevity. One thing that all of them had in common was work, outdoor exercise, and a desire to live. So you're going to ask me, how long am I going to live? Well, I make it to 125, I guess.
Tony Piero.
Just like anything that's alive. You take good care of it, it lasts longer. That's the whole secret. You don't create trouble for somebody else. You don't get trouble back.
Russell Buchanan.
Just admire it and what you eat, especially what you drink. I stick to a little bit of beer and I don't recall any liquor. Stop smoking, 1949. I haven't smoked ever since then. I think that's over 60 years ago.
George Johnson.
As long as I feel like I do now, my voice is getting a little crusty, but as long as I feel just like I do now, I feel just like I did with 110. As long as you don't have any pain, no constant ache, I think the average person would feel just as normal, you know what I mean? A lot of them will say, I lived a lonesome life. But I say this, my secret is this, don't find little things to upset you. See what I mean? Don't find little things to upset you. You're never going to be satisfied with everything. So if you're going to let the little things accept you, affect you, they're gradually going to build into larger things.
I came to think of the World War I veterans as Generation One, born in the 19th century, the first eyewitnesses of the 20th, holding on into the 21st. They remember the world before the airplane, before the Soviet Union, before radio, a quieter time. And these are quiet men. They're curious about the contemporary world, but many, or perhaps most of them, have become scholars of their own long-ago time, a time most of us have forgotten. They care about how people remember the First World War. They want to be remembered. Frank Buckles.
President of France, Jacques Chirac, decided to give the surviving members of the French army, give them the Legion d'honneur, and he decided to include the Americans. I became a member. A few people knew that I had been in World War I, but not more than five or six people. And leading my daughter and wife. I never told them about it.
Lloyd Brown.
I used to belong to an organization of World War I people. But I think they got so, the number of members became exhausted.
They had a magazine.
Yeah, all the subscribers died.
The starting point of knowledge is the story. Begin with a story and you can travel through time. The veterans of World War I had taken me in a time machine with their stories, and they were expert navigators. But they were very old men, and the ultimate story was still to be told, and they wouldn't be around to tell it. I wanted to know their feelings about what happens next when you cross to the other side. The results were mixed. Samuel Goldberg.
You're dead. What do you mean? What do you mean, heaven and hell and... Oh, no, no. I'm not in any way religious.
John Babcock.
I think that if you live a good life here, you have a chance afterward. I think if you lead a bad life, you have a chance to go to hell. I think there's a hell and a heaven. I'd hate to think this all just happened by itself, and I don't think it could.
Frank Buckles.
I know what I'm supposed to think, but I just don't see how it's going to be possible. When you pass 100, you start counting the years, then you know that there's a final end of it. Up until then, you don't give it much thought.
After you die, I think that's the end of your life under any circumstances. You're gone. You're gone forever. When that consciousness leaves the brain, that is the end of it. That is the end of your life, your existence on this earth.
The latter was George Johnson, 112 years old when I interviewed him in May. He lived alone in the house that he and his late wife had built in the California Bay Area in 1930. He was blind but in great health, a loud-talking soothsayer with a sharp wit and great stories. George introduced me to another reality of this search for World War I veterans, one that I hadn't thought much about, until George died 2 months later. He was the oldest man in California, and I suppose I should have seen it coming. I had gathered these men around me like old pals, and suddenly one was missing. And then a month later, 109-year-old Homer Anderson passed away. He had trained for the Balloon Corps in World War I, an aborted effort by the Army to send men over the enemy lines in helium balloons, which the Army discontinued when it was determined that the balloonists presented too tempting a target for the enemy.
I was in a balloon section for quite a while. It was a training team, and that's all we got done. We didn't get any engagements, and I was awful happy about that.
As an interview subject, he was what I'd come to think of as a drifter, nailing a question solidly but then drifting to other topics, other wars, places where I had trouble following. He once surprised me by calling out to his late wife, gone more than 20 years. Perhaps she was already beckoning him from the other side. A month later, he was gone. When you meet a veteran of World War I, you're in their life for a couple of hours, as long as it takes, but they stick with you for weeks and months as you hear their words over and over. Their way of speaking, their values, their sense of life, it all starts to work its way in. You don't want them to go, but you know they will. And then one day the circle is completed. The era is over, and the veterans of World War I will join the ranks of those who gave their service in other wars, in other times. For every army raised by an Alexander or a Nero, or Napoleon, or Pershing, or Patton, there must be the last man standing, the last eyewitness, the last link. And then, that era is relinquished to history. But this is a tribute to the living. While one eyewitness is alive, World War I is living history. World War I is truly the forgotten war. Its causes are vague, its goals unclear, its heroes largely forgotten. I approached the subject of World War I with the memory of a Belgian veteran peering into a trench one rainy day a dozen years ago, looking for whatever would turn up in the mud. Time will move beyond World War I, as it will move beyond World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq. Time moved beyond that 90-something veteran I met in Belgium, but the legacies of his war are with us today. World War I was the beginning of the New World Order. The United States, which lost comparatively few lives in the war, gained the most in terms of international stature. American values were shaped by the events of 1917 and 1918. World War I also gave us the Treaty of Versailles, and with it the economic strangulation of Germany that gave rise to Adolf Hitler and the death of millions. World War I gave Russia the impetus to raise a 12 million man army, and with the famine and hardship that resulted, brought the 300-year-old House of Romanov to an end, giving birth to the Soviet Union. It killed the European monarchies and gave birth to parliamentary rule across the continent. A complete understanding of the 20th century begins with a study of the First World War. the bungling course set by a handful of diplomats, politicians, and generals in 1914 is the course we sail by today. Those men are gone, but another handful remain as witnesses to a fading time, an obsolete idealism, and a universal love of liberty. It is to these surviving veterans of World War I that this program is dedicated. My name is Will Everett. You've been listening to the World War I Living History Project. Major funding provided by the University of Texas Brownsville, Texas Southmost College, www.utb.edu, and the South Padre Island, Texas Convention and Visitors Bureau, online at sopadre.com. Additional support comes from the Liberty Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri, the National World War I Monument and Museum, online at libertymemorialmuseum.org, Creative Care Consultants, in honor of Charles E. Waldron, Jr., and by the Marine Military Academy in Harlingen, Texas, educating young men in the 8th through 12th grade and 1 year post-graduation, styled in the beliefs of the U.S. Marine Corps. Online at www.mma-tx.org. Voices in Hour 1 include Ray Stewart, Chris and Eve de Diesbach, Gerald Scherer, John Rogans, and Andy Hancock. Original music by Chuck Wild, used by permission of Gold Mask Music, ASCAP. Videography and production assistance by Joel Lamar. The World War I Living History Project was written and produced by Will Everett. Special thanks to Veterans Affairs Liaison Chris Scheer and guest host Walter Cronkite, as well as Carl DiCapo, General Stephen Burkheiser, Charles Waldron Jr., Robert Machen, and Charles Waldron III. To order a CD set of this program, visit www.thelivinghistoryproject.org, where you'll find video and audio samples, contact information, and links to more information about the First World War. This has been a creation of Treehouse Productions.
This Memorial Day, Peace Talks Radio presents Taken Too Soon, The Cost of War. Nearly 40 public radio producers from around the world lend their voices to a roll call of just some of the names of casualties from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, including coalition soldiers, Iraqi and Afghan civilians, contractors, and journalists. That's Taken Too Soon, The Cost of War, this afternoon at 1, here on WILL Urbana.
The holiday forecast for Champaign-Urbana, there's a good chance of showers and thunderstorms today with a high around 80 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms likely tonight as well, the low 52. Cloudy skies tomorrow, a chance of showers. The high around 65, mostly cloudy tomorrow night, the low 48. Partly sunny Wednesday with a high of 68. Wednesday night and Thursday, mostly clear skies. The low around 45, the high 72 degrees. This is WILL Urbana.